Jeremy Brecker, welcome again to KBOO.
Very good to be with you again, Bill, and very good to be with your audience. I'm so glad that they're here and engaged and concerned about these questions.
Oh, boy, are they. Let me introduce you, Jeremy. You're an engaged scholar, wrote 13 books, including the book Strike, and explored the great working class of peoples throughout U.S. history. It's a book that has deeply influenced labor scholarship. It's a classic that he is constantly updating in new editions. More recently, he wrote the book Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action, that discusses people power when the conditions of their life become intolerable, when they say enough, refuse to work, march, obstruct, sit down, and stand up in mass strikes. As an activist, he co-founded the Labor Network for Sustainability, that has won a great deal of union and worker support, and his vita includes many acts of civil disobedience and arrests, starting in the 1960s in support of civil rights and labor movements, and today demanding climate action by this country's leadership. Today we're going to discuss the long struggle, over 50 years now, beginning in the early 1970s, between the corporate forces and the climate action movements, how that struggle has developed and is now emerging with greatly increased intensity. So, Jeremy Brecker, give us a sketch of the growing struggle as it will be updated in the next issue of your book, Strike.
Well, I'm glad you put it in the context of Strike, because I think that, well, most of Strike deals with what we think of as the struggles over labor issues, wages, hours, right to organize a union, and other basic labor rights. In fact, what's happening today is that protecting working people against the devastating effects of climate change is becoming and must become a central aspect of the struggle of working people for human rights and a better life. So one of the things we are seeing today, and one of the things I'm involved with, is the growing participation of workers and the labor movement in the struggle to protect the climate. And it's hardly surprising that this is happening because, first of all, working people are threatened, like everyone, by the climate emergency, but they are threatened not only in the rest of their lives, but also in their work lives and in the security of their economic situation, which is, although it's not always recognized, being heavily threatened by climate change. And so for working people, there's that extra form of threat from the emergency of climate change. Very often we're told, well, we have to make a choice between jobs and climate protection. But the reality is that climate change is the greatest threat to jobs, employment, and economic security that our country has ever known. And that for unions, they can no longer say, well, if you want to do something about climate, join an environmental organization. We have to say, and more organized groups of workers are saying, this is a labor issue, this is a worker issue. We have to become involved in standing up to the threat of climate change. And the second reason, which is getting back to your original question, is that we often find that the enemies of working people on the job, and especially in the political arena, people like the Koch brothers and other advocates of basically labor repression and eliminating all rights for working people, are also among the leading proponents of let the fossil fuel companies do whatever they want, let them pour their poisons and their climate-destroying chemicals into the atmosphere and prevent anybody, workers, environmentalists, just ordinary folks who want a future for themselves and their kids, prevent them from getting in the way and interfering with the power of the fossil fuel industry and its other allies to make profit by, as Bill McKibben said, their business plan is to destroy the planet.
On the other side of it, though, is that they recognize, my sense is many of them recognize that climate change is real, and indeed they even have to change, although of course they want to change very slowly, and time is running short. But they have a big megaphone, not because they have a movement, but because they're dominant in politics and the media. Do you see people being able to see through what is a corporate program, although the corporations haven't sat down together, some kind of big meeting, a great conference, and hammered out a program saying this is what capitalism wants to do. But every industry, in fact, is now claiming to be responding, mostly greenwashing. But, you know, the auto industry wants to keep building cars, of course, but they're willing to do it in electric cars as long as it's done slowly so it doesn't strand their assets. Can people see through that smokescreen of capital, and are they mobilizing towards what I see as the left program that's also emerging somehow organically and not through some kind of big conference?
So certainly we are coming out of a situation in which a great deal of what you might say smokescreen, giving people false ideas about what would be effective means of fighting climate change. After all, if you go back not very long, you'll find that the dominant discourse around climate change was, oh, individuals have to throw away their gum wrappers rather than burning them. People have to individually buy electric cars, and if they can't afford electric cars, well, they're bad people. Why don't they give up feeding their children and putting shoes on their feet in order to buy electric cars? A completely individualized view of what it meant to fight climate change, one that was based on the idea that people were only consumers and not either part of the political system or activists or part of communities with common interests. And I think we've gone a long way beyond that. I think most people do recognize that the needs for climate protection require a fundamental change in the entire energy system, and that that includes not only how we produce energy and that we need to shift to renewable forms of energy like wind and solar, but also that we have to find ways to use energy more efficiently, that we have to insulate our buildings, that we have to shift to non-gasoline-based vehicles. And I think that those ideas are pretty widely grasped. I think the number of people who say, well, climate change isn't real or it isn't really a threat has really diminished, and that shows both in the polls and I think in the political discourse. You can see that there aren't nearly as many politicians who are willing to say, oh, this doesn't matter, it's never going to affect you. I think when you get to the finer points, that there is a lot of deliberate smokescreen and confusion that has made it difficult for people to figure out what is effective climate protection and what is basically a way for one or another group of business people to make a buck without significantly affecting climate change. And I think in analyzing this, and we may disagree about this, and that's fine, because it's by disagreement and argument that we come to correct conclusions. So I hope if you disagree, Bill, you'll say what you think about it. But it seems to me that there is quite a range of different opinions and interests on the part of what we can broadly call the capitalist class that is quite different, both in the interests and in the policies. So first of all, even within the fossil fuel sector, there is considerable disagreement. I don't know if you or your readers noticed this, but there were big attacks in the coal industries from coal companies and their associations attacking Joe Manchin for selling them out in the interest of the oil industry, and very, very big attacks on him by the coal operators. So here we see coal has one agenda, oil has another agenda. The fossil fuel corporations as a whole have a more or less common agenda with little disagreements of that kind, and they exercise enormous influence over the rest of the business community. But I wouldn't say it's accurate to say that the corporate program for climate protection, as weak and inadequate as it may be, is the same as the fossil fuel industries. Fossil fuel industry is heavily oriented towards one thing, which is to be able to keep producing and selling fossil fuels. And for that, the core of their smokescreen lies in, for example, one of the most dubious of all climate protection policies, carbon capture, and the idea that you're going to capture the carbon in the smokestack, or even more implausible, that you're going to capture it in the open air and then turn it into something that you can burn or build houses out of or bury in the ground. This has almost no scientific support, but the companies that are specifically fossil fuel, especially gas and oil, and also to some extent coal, want to have this purported solution as a means of continuing with their business, which is producing and selling fossil fuels. The broader, let's take finance as another example, though. For finance, the attractive strategies for climate protection or pseudo-climate protection tend more to what are called market-based systems, things like cap-and-trade systems, for example, which they have made a lot of money on, especially in Europe, and could hope to make a lot more money on worldwide, because they are basically the people who organize and then speculate within those so-called cap-and-trade systems. So my point is, you have to break it down a little bit more complexly than just saying there's a capitalist plan. There are a number of plans that different groups of capitalists are attracted to and promoting. That said, from the side of people who actually care about protecting the climate and the environment, I think what's crucial is that we develop and present a plan and an approach and a strategy for climate protection, which, first of all, is effective. Second of all, meets the interests of the wide majority of people, the working class considered in its widest definition of basically everyone who has to work for a living, and that it can be persuasively presented as not a threat to jobs and not a threat to the economic well-being of people, but as a way to realize jobs and to realize the economic well-being of the majority of people.
This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. You've been listening to me, Bill Resnick, interviewing Jeremy Bricker, an engaged scholar. Multiple arrests for civil disobedience and civil rights, feminists, anti-war and anti-nuclear power struggles, among other actions. So, Jeremy, you pointed out that the oil interests and the coal interests have attacked each other. Indeed, the coal people have attacked Joe Manchin, a fellow coal millionaire, attacked him for selling out to the oil billionaires. But in the big picture, what we see are getting in Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, better called the Climate Action Act, is that both the oil and coal companies are getting large appropriations for research and development of carbon capture and sequestration. The nuclear power industry also got what it wanted. The automobile industry got big subsidies for their research and development of electric cars, and also big public subsidies for buying the cars, which really amounts to handing the car producers even more funds. And the big banks all are seeking guaranteed loans, especially for building the grids. And they're joining with the construction companies to push to build big grids across rivers and mountains and farmlands and do it on cost-plus contracts. And the small banks want guaranteed loans for homeowners installing solar panels and buying electric cars. That's not to say that the Biden plan is all bad. In fact, it includes substantial monies for the LEFT plan, which we'll talk about next week, and in particular for local community energy. Anyway, the corporate predation and going to the federal trough, that's one side of the corporate plan to line their pockets. The other side is to solidify corporate capitalism by taking no actions to change the fundamentals of their system, with growth at its heart, more production, more sales, more profits into the indefinite future. Though they offer one major exception to companies, they are promising to replace fossil fuel burning to power the economy with clean and green energy to stop greenhouse gas emissions, though that part of the plan has one caveat. It has to be done slowly because the investor-owned utilities and in the corporate plan would retain control of electricity supply. Those corporate and the investor-owned utilities do not want to strand assets like coal and gas plants until the debt used to build them is fully retired. And the big banks and finance industry that in the corporate plan would retain one of their great year-in and year-out profit centers by underwriting the bonding and investing in the debt, they also can't afford stranded and defaulted debts. And take, for example, the auto companies. They're perfectly happy to go to electric vehicles, though slowly, of course, no stranding of assets. And they will resist any effort to replace much of car driving with public transit, even resist any weight limits to the cars and SUVs and trucks. This corporate program has one notable weakness. Unlike the left program that has innumerable social movements supporting it, everything from the Sierra Club to 350.org and the Audubon Society, and then many other more radical organizations, the corporate program relies on their domination of the economy, politics, and media. They use this domination to get their message across to the great public. This is what they argue. They are committed to stopping climate change. That they, over this country's history, this is more of them, have proved themselves the innovators who get things done. These corporatists claim that you cannot depend on the dreamy left and their plan to use intermittent sun and wind energy and spread it throughout the country. The sun doesn't shine nor the wind blow all the time, they say. They argue that while we need stable, reliable energy to power this country, and our plan, while using a lot of sun and wind, will develop all other clean sources of energy, a new breed of small, safe nuclear facilities, the so-called hydrogen economy, carbon capture, even agricultural move towards soil generation to fix carbon in the new corporate economy. These are all empty promises and profoundly misleading. But they can deluge the public, plant their propaganda in stories and newspapers and magazines, also in social media, on the internet, of course, in news, interviews, public affairs shows, and their advertising. And conservative politicians will amplify that message. In fact, they're doing it now and promote it through legislation that they will promote. At some point, maybe soon, when push comes to shove and the people must decide on which plan to support, the corporations will deluge the U.S. population in ways that make current mass advertising and presidential elections in the contested states make it appear mild and temperate.
Well, what you're saying is that there's a capitalist program to maintain capitalism. I would find that difficult to argue with. How that plays out in terms of specific climate policies is another question.
I agree. There's all sorts of possibilities of those struggles. So, folks, with that, it's time to sign off. Jeremy Brecker will say more in part two coming up next week. He will say more on the issue of the corporate plan and their power. And then we'll discuss the superiority of the left program. And finally, next week, discuss how we can prevail, how we can both stop climate change and gain that other necessary, possible, democratic, and sustainable world. In fact, I believe we can only stop climate change by building that other world. If capital, in fact, gets the authority to deal with climate change and make the necessary changes, we're doomed. They'll go very slowly. They'll predate on the economy, as in the military budget, with Raytheon, Lockheed, and all the others getting cost-plus contracts for weapon systems that they never develop, that, in fact, get canceled after the first prototype. Jeremy Brecker, writer, activist, keep up the great work.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be with you.